Erev Tov, and welcome back to our continuing series of discussions and analysis of Haggadah Shel Pesach. This is the fifth podcast in the series, and this evening I would like to examine a very popular text, but a text which, if we take a look at it, is riddled with difficulties, and is a text which does not appear really as the core Haggadah. First shows up in the 9th century in Rav Sadia Gaon's Haggadah as an optional addition to sing. It does not show up in the Rambam's Haggadah, but quickly became assimilated into the mainstream Haggadot, and that is the doubled song that we are familiar with called Dayenu, or that, at least that's how we refer to it. Very popular both for its refrain and the tune that people sing. And it really is made up of two paragraphs. Its location in the Haggadah, if you're following in the Haggadah, just to point you to it, its location in the traditional Haggadah is found just after the three Midrashim that expand the number of the Makot, of the plagues, from 10 to 50 at the sea, to 200 at the sea, to 250 at the sea. And it is immediately followed by Rabban Gamliel's obligation, which we're going to talk about tomorrow night. Rabban Gamliel's obligation of Pesach Matzah Maror, actually we're going to talk about it tonight, we'll talk about it tomorrow night in a very different context, of the obligation of Pesach Matzah Maror. So I'd like to pose seven questions about the Dayenu. Dayenu begins with the opening line, Kama ma'alot tovot la'makom aleinu. And this passage itself is an introductory passage, has two words in it which are a little bit strange. The first one is ma'alot. What we want to express in this song is that God has done many, many kind things for us. We want to thank Him for all of these kind things. But the way that we would say a kind thing would be chasadim tovim, good kindnesses. We use it in our tefillah all the time. Why does this relatively rare word and a very rare word in this context, and this meaning used here, ma'alot tovot. The second one is, why is God referred to by the rabbinic sabraket makom? Why does it not say, kama ma'alot tovot la'shem aleinu, kama ma'alot tovot le'eloheinu aleinu, kama ma'alot tovot la'kadosh baruch hu aleinu? Why here the word makom? Now that's a little bit of a cheat question, and therefore I'm not going to count it as a separate question, it's still part of the first question. Because the word makom indeed does show up several times in the Haggadah, Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu, and therefore it may indeed be for some other reason part of the liturgical nuance of the Haggadah. But nonetheless, Kama Ma'alot Tovot La'Makom Aleinu is a difficult phrase. The second difficulty is found when we look at the list itself. It seems to be a list of things that God has done for us through this course of the Exodus. And nonetheless, to be honest with ourselves, the list is somewhat, shall we say, artificially inflated. So for instance, the second item on the list is that God did plagues against the Egyptians. God visited the Egyptians with plagues. The third item on the list is that he visited the gods of Egypt with plagues. And the fourth item on the list is that he killed the firstborn. Well, indeed, killing the firstborn seems to be the main plague. And the attack against the images of Egyptian religiosity, whether it be the Nile, or perhaps some suggest that the frogs, was also an attack of that sort, seems to just be part of the issue of the plague. So to turn one item into three items is a little bit strange. Similarly, when you move down the list, you see that God split the sea for us. The next item is He walked us through in dry land. And the third item is that He drowned our enemies. That's all part of one event. After all, splitting the sea, the point of splitting the sea was for us to be able to walk through and them not to be able to follow us. The next two items, fed us in the desert for 40 years and fed us the man. Well, feeding us the man was how He supported us in the desert. Yes, He did other things, but the man is an example of the previous item. Most famously, towards the end of the list, He brought us close to Mount Sinai and gave us the Torah. Well, the whole point of coming to close to Mount Sinai is giving us the Torah. So truth to be told, many of the traditional commentators on the Haggadah belabor, or shall we say, invest much labor into trying to solving these relatively seemingly intractable problems to explain why what the significance of the splitting of the sea independent of our walking through on dry land or the Egyptians being buried. Famously, they discuss many, many different perspectives and beautiful perspectives, the significance of coming close to Mount Sinai independent of the giving of the Torah. But if we look at this text honestly, we see that the text, again, seems to be inflated, but inflated in curious places. So, for instance, there is an emphasis on the expansion of the plagues, not in details of the plagues, but the plagues and the plagues against the gods and killing the firstborn. And yet, when we come close to Mount Sinai, there's only the item of coming close to Mount Sinai and giving us the Torah. Other items that certainly could have been listed there. The war against Amalek is not mentioned here. Wars against other nations in the desert are not mentioned here. So it seems to be a selective inflation. We have to figure out why. That is question number two. Question number three is again on the list. This is an evening of Yetziat Mitzrayim. It's an evening where we are commemorating, we're celebrating, we're reenacting, and ultimately trying to re-experience the Exodus from Egypt. Well, the Exodus from Egypt, writ small, takes us from servitude in Egypt, perhaps across the sea, as we see our enemies drown. Writ large, one might argue that it takes us all the way to the foot of Mount Sinai and to the Revelation. And writ super large, one could argue, takes us all the way across the Jordan River. But to take us all the way to a built Beit HaMikdash, to a built temple in Jerusalem, which is the last item on the list, that is a far cry from Yetziat Mitzrayim. That takes us hundreds of years past the Exodus. So how did that get on the list? So that is question number four. Question number five takes us to the very next paragraph. The next paragraph is a repeat of the list. And it begins with a curious line. Alachat kama v'chama tova chulo velat lam makom aleinu. Again, the makom. But alachat kama v'chama is not an inspiring phrase. It's not a spiritual type of phrase. It's not a phrase of great nobility or glory. It's a legal phrase that belongs as part of a syllogism. When one is to argue that a case could be made for X and proves it by saying that even the less obvious case of Y, this condition obtains, one says, if it obtains in the case of Y, then al achat kama v'chama, how much more so, it should obtain in the case of X. It's one that's used in Talmudic argumentation, how much more so. What is it doing here in the middle of this song? That is the fifth question. The sixth question on this passage is what the relationship is between the two paragraphs. In other words, why is there a repeated paragraph, one which lists all the items that God did in an if but not sense, and then the other one that just lists them as a straight list. And conventional custom, I wouldn't say conventional understanding, conventional custom maintains the first paragraph is the main paragraph. That's the one where everybody sings and gets all excited. Second paragraph, most people, if they read it, they zip through it. We have to see what the relationship between the two paragraphs is. The final question, of course, is the granddaddy of all questions, which is Dayenu. Dayenu means it would have been enough. In the first paragraph, we start out by saying, if God had taken us out of Egypt and not done plagues, it would have been enough. Well, one could argue that had we gotten out of Egypt without the Egyptian suffering, that would have been enough. It might not have made the point that the Exodus was supposed to make, and that is a theological study, that a textual and theological study through the first few chapters of Shemot. But certainly, one cannot argue that if God had taken us out and not split the sea, that would have been enough. We would have died right there, or split the sea and not walked us through it. And what would have been the point? How can we possibly say Dayenu? To have taken us to the desert and not taken care of us, we would have died there. So the word Dayenu, the phrase Dayenu, is very difficult. And everybody who encounters it, who is paying attention, asks the question, how can we possibly say Dayenu? So we have seven questions. And again, to reiterate the questions, question number one is, why are God's kindnesses here called Ma'alot? Why, parenthetically, is God referred to in both introductory lines as Makom? Second one is, why is this list seemingly artificially inflated? Item number three is, why does this list take us all the way to Binyan Beit HaMikdash, the building of the Beit HaMikdash, well past the normal time and space parameters of Yetziat Mitzrayim. Fourth question is, why does the next paragraph start with this syllogistic line of Al Achad Kama V'Chama? Fifth question is why do we in general have the second list? Well, what is the function of the second list here? I skipped a question somewhere in the summary, but the final question, of course, is how do we possibly explain the phrase Dayin? So let's start at the very beginning. Very good place to start. And we'll see, we will try to solve this in the course of the next 19 and a half minutes remain to us. Start with the following. We start the evening with an assumption, which in some of the early podcasts I already addressed, but it's an assumption which I think we could safely say is a wrong assumption, and that is that this evening is about commemorating a particular event that took place at a particular time to our ancestors, and that is the event of the Exodus. The evening is not only about the Exodus. The Exodus becomes a focal point for our discussion, analysis, celebration, reenactment, re-experiencing, etc., of all of Jewish history. And that includes Avraham, and that includes Lavan, and that includes the plague over Jerusalem alluded to in the Midrash about the Cherev, and that includes the end of days alluded to in the Midrash about the Dam, etc. We go all over the place through Jewish history, and indeed, by the time that we get to the end of the meal, or perhaps at the beginning of the meal, we are already in Jerusalem, Beit HaMikdash is built, we're eating the Korban Pesach, etc. And that I spoke about briefly in the first of this series of podcasts. As such, this presentation, and I do want to add in one more question to it, which will be answered forthwith, is that this piece here that we sing, this Dayenu piece, seems to belong, as mentioned in the last shiur, to the realm of shira, of singing, and not to storytelling. And yet, it's placed in the middle of storytelling. We don't have the custom here to cover the matzah and raise the wine as we do for Yish Amda, our song at the end. And it's placed just before Rabban Gamliel. The question is, why the location? Why is it there? So again, back to our direction. The evening is about celebrating all of Jewish history. And as such, the author, who some argue, the Abravanel argues that the author of this paragraph is Rabbi Akiva. He chiefly argues it because the last rabbi to be mentioned in the previous paragraph was Rabbi Akiva, who was expanding the list of plagues. In the next year, we'll talk about another possible reason for the authorship of this paragraph of Dayenu. That'll be from a very different perspective. This author is clearly trying to expand the scope of the evening to something beyond just the Exodus, but all the way to the Beit HaMikdash. And the reason for that is very simple. Most will agree that this piece was composed after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And as such, we have to stop and ask ourselves. Here we are in the shadow of the ruins of the Beit HaMikdash. Here we are in Jerusalem, or in Bavel, or in the Galil. The Beit HaMikdash is no more. We have no more Korban Pesach, at least temporarily. And we have to think, what is the function of this evening? After all, this evening, up until now, up until the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, was an evening of celebration of the highest moment of Jewish existence, which is being actuated. Here we are coming to Yerushalayim. Here we are celebrating in the Beit HaMikdash. We are settled in our land. During much of that period, we're sovereign in our land. This is exactly what Pesach was supposed to be about. We were taken out of Egypt to be a free and sovereign people in our own land, who would create, ideally, a state or a kingdom that exemplified the best of God's values and God's laws, that we would teach the rest of the world to come close to God. That was the goal. Here we are in the shadow of all of that. How can we possibly do it? So what the author clearly does is tries to take us back to the Beit HaMikdash by walking us from Egypt through the desert, to Mount Sinai, but into Israel, into the built Beit HaMikdash, to help us sort of restore that and regain the vision of what this evening is supposed to be all about. Very good. And to bring us to the Beit HaMikdash, he not only mentions the Beit HaMikdash, but he brings us into the Beit HaMikdash in several powerful but subtle ways. The first way is that he constructs a ladder of kindnesses that God has done for us, It is made up of 15 steps. Why 15 steps? Take a look at the Mishnah towards the end of Masechet Sukkah, which describes the Beit HaMikdash. Now, we have to remember that this was composed at the very earliest after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, but not long afterwards, according to the earliest opinions, not long after the destruction, which means the author may himself have had and certainly met people who had personal recollections of the Second Temple. Towards the end of the Second Temple period, the Mishnah Sukkah tells us they created a separate area for the women, and there were 15 steps that went from the men's section to the women's section. And on those 15 steps, the Levites stood and sang to God. That's where they would sing Shira. And those 15 steps corresponded to the 15 songs of ascents that are in Psalms 120 through 134 inclusive. And those steps are called in Hebrew Ma'alot. So now we can see several ways in which the author subtly takes us back to the Beit HaMikdash. Besides the overt mention of the Beit HaMikdash at the end, he, as we said, artificially inflates the list. And by artificially, I don't mean that there's anything dishonest here, but using a turn here and a turn there adds another item to the list here and there, so that we end up with 15 items on the list. And then what does he call these items? Not kindnesses, not good deeds, but rather ma'alot, advantages, as it were, saying that to remind us of the 15 ma'alot in the Beit HaMikdash. And perhaps that's why he refers to God here as makom, which literally means place. And in Tanakh, makom actually usually means, and the interested reader will take a look at Yirmiyahu Perek Zayin, Pasuk Yod Zayin, makom means a holy place. So the makom is again a reference or an allusion to the Beit HaMikdash. Good, so we've answered a couple of the first couple of questions. But then we have to get to the structure of what's going on here. Why particular things are added, particular things are not added. You have to look at the location of Dayenu within the context of Haggadah. Dayenu, as I said, is placed, and it seems to be a song, and yet it's placed right after telling the main story of Arami Oved Avi, and right before the declaration of the meaning of the symbols of the food, Pesach Matzah Maror. So you notice that Pesach Matzah Maror, which Rabbi Gamliel, in the end of the first century, authored this statement that everyone has to explain what the symbols mean, but the symbols certainly predate Rabbi Gamliel. They're in the Torah. The Torah says you have to eat Pesach, and you have to eat it with Matzah Maror. You have to eat the Paschal lamb with some unleavened bread and with some bitter herbs. And so that connection is something that was the source of a dispute during Temple times of how the Pesach should be. How do we interpret the phrase that al matzot marim yachlu, the Pesach should be eaten al, which could mean on or with matzah and maror. So Hillel was of the opinion that really had to be eaten together. He had to take Pesach, matzah and maror, and eat them together. Halachically, Hillel had whatever perspective he had on al. But phenomenologically and experientially, what is being stated about this? So we have to look at Rabbi Gamliel's statement that explains what Pesach, matzah and maror mean. What does Pesach mean? So the answer is Pesach is a paschal sacrifice celebrating the fact that God jumped over or skipped over or protected our houses when he destroyed when he killed the Egyptians and saved our houses. That's the verse from Exodus that we quote. What does matzah represent? Matzah represents not the fact that we ate matzah as slaves, even though the text says that's true, but the point that the text makes about why we eat matzah on Pesach is because we did not have time to let the dough rise, and we had to run out of Egypt very quickly. Maror is because they embittered our lives. Those are the statements that we make. But there's something symbolic and something representational about each one of these things. And I'd like to offer the following thesis, not only about Pesach Matzah Maror, but about something quite larger that we don't have time to get into fully now, but perhaps in a future podcast. And that is that Chazal, our rabbis, understood that the frame of Yetziat Mitzrayim, writ large, meaning from the Exodus from Egypt all the way until the end of the desert sojourn, was a template for all of Jewish history. And all of Jewish history, as an example, the rabbis identifying Tisha B'Av as having started in the desert, and Shivasa B'Tammuz as starting in the desert, etc., meant that they understood that that time period was what established the patterns for Jewish history, and every bit of Jewish history that plays out is just some variation or another on a theme that first happened in the desert. As such, Pesach Matzah Maror are not just foods that we eat or representations of stages in the desert, but they're representations of stages in Jewish history. And I would go so far as to say that every moment in Jewish history can be identified as a Pesach moment, a Matzah moment, or a Maror moment. I'll explain. What is it that the Pesach represents? The Pesach does not represent freedom. Here's a Korban Pesach being eaten by people, a royal meal being eaten by people who are sitting in houses, protected by the divine protection associated with the blood on the door, while next door their neighbors are screaming because the children are dying. And this Pesach, this Korban Pesach, is representative not of freedom, but of royalty, of chosenness, of closeness to God, of being recognized by everyone around and understanding yourself that you have a special, intimate relationship, an exclusive relationship with God. And that is exemplified by the fact that halachically the Korban Pesach has to be eaten al hasova. It has to be eaten at the end of the meal on a full stomach. As the Gemara says, ka'achilat melachim, like royal food. Only kings bring out a roasted lamb for dessert. It has to be l'moshcha v'l'gdula, like the Rambam says. The Korbanot in general and the Pesach specifically have to be eaten like food of royalty. We eat it reclining, etc. Therefore, that's what Pesach represents. And there's certainly moments in Jewish history, whether they be the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash, or whether they be the victory of the Hashmonaim over the Greeks, or whether they be the 5th of Iyar in 1948 when the State of Israel was declared. There are moments in Jewish history that are Pesach moments, moments in which the entire world turns around and looks and sees these are God's people. Then again, it's very easy, unfortunately, to identify the fact that there are many moments in Jewish history that are Maror moments, that are moments of bitter herbs. Auschwitz was a Maror moment. Crusades were Maror moments. One can, unfortunately, point very easily to many, many bitter moments in Jewish history. But there's also matzah. What is matzah? Matzah, although it really goes along with maror as the food of slaves, we say at the beginning of the Seder, halach manya, this is the bread of poverty we ate when our ancestors ate in Egypt. Nonetheless, matzah, the way it's presented in the text, what does Rav Gamliel say? Why do we eat matzah? Because we didn't have time for dough to rise before we left Egypt, which is a little bit strange considering we had advanced warning. Matzah is the food of refugees. It's not the food of slaves, even though it is. That's not its function here. It's not the food of slaves, but it's also not the food of kings. It's the food of refugees, of people who are free but are running. They are not kings yet, but they're on their way. And every moment in Jewish history is either a maror moment, or it's the process of going from maror to Pesach, that's matzah, or it's the Pesach moment when you arrive home. To put it sort of in very succinct 1940s terms, it's very easy to point to the death camps as maror. It'd be hard to point to it as anything else. And it is equally easy to point to May 14th, 1948, the Declaration of the State of Israel as a Pesach moment. But as the title of the award-winning movie put out by the Simon Wiesenthal Center goes, the long way home, the process of the DP camps, and long marches to get over land and over sea and under and hidden in boats, etc., to get to Eretz Yisrael to help fight for the state and build the state before it was started. That's matzah. That's the process. That's the long way home. And so every moment belongs like that. So what is it that Hillel's saying? It's a very strange phenomenon that I personally have observed many times. Growing up, I met many people who were very, very excited about being Jewish, but they could only get excited about it on Simchas Torah and on Purim. They didn't know how to identify with Jewish sadness. They just didn't speak to them. And they didn't really want to have anything to do with it. They barely could stand in shul for Yom Kippur. I knew a few people like that. I knew far more people who had the opposite. They would be at every house of mourning. They'd be at every funeral, as it were. They would be all day in shul and Yom Kippur, and they knew how to be very somber. But their happiness was something away from the shul. Their happiness was something away from Judaism. Their rejoicing was something that was part of their secular life. They didn't know any way to integrate happiness into who they were as Jews. Hillel's making a very powerful statement. He says to be a member of Am Yisrael, which is basically what Seder night is. It's first and foremost about inclusion and membership with the destiny, the history and the destiny of Klal Yisrael. And to do so means to embrace both the Maror and the Matzah and the Pesach and take it all in at once. That's what Hillel says you have to do as far as eating. When Gamliel comes along, his own descendant comes along a few generations later and says, you also have to explain the symbols. You have to explain what they mean before you eat them so that you understand what it is that you're eating and what the significance of them is. Now, roll back to this piece of poetry that appears in our Haggadot just before Rabban Gamliel's declaration, and you notice something curious. Not only did the author put together a list of 15 items taking us back to the Beit HaMikdash, but the author very brilliantly organized them into three sets of five. Take a look. What are the first five items? He took us out of Egypt, caused plagues against their gods, killed the firstborn, and gave us their money. All five of those things, and only those five things, took place in Egypt. I submit to you that those five are maror, bitter herbs. That's Egypt. What about the next five? Splitting the sea, walking us through on dry land, drowning our enemies in it, taking care of us for 40 years, and feeding us manna. That's all about the road. That's all about the journey, going through the sea and being taken care of for 40 years. That, I submit to you, is matzah. And the next five, Shabbat, Har Sinai, Torah, Eretz Yisrael, Beit HaMikdash, have nothing to do with enemies, have nothing to do with the desert, they have everything to do with coming close to God. And that, I submit to you, is Pesach. And so therefore, the author, we'll say Rabbi Akiva for right now, very cleverly bundled for us five items of Maror, five items of Matzah, and five items of Pesach, create against this, again, this triumvirate of Jewish experience, however, in the opposite direction of Rabban Gamliel. Because Dayenu is an experiential song in which we go through the road of our experience, starting in Egypt and ending in Yerushalayim. Rabban Gamliel is a teleological statement. You look at the main goal. The main goal of the Exodus was the Pesach. Matzah and the Maror are steps along the way that we need in order to get there. So now we can understand, perhaps more deeply, not only the items on the list, but the organization of the list. But then we get to the difficulty with the second passage. In order to answer that, we have to answer the big question, which is the Dayenu question. We have to ask, what is the purpose of this entire evening? The purpose of this entire evening is not to tell a story. This I spoke about in the first podcast. The goal of the evening, and I spoke about it in the last podcast, is to sing to God, to give thanks to God. The main word in the entire Haggadah that turns us around is Lefichach. After all is said and done, therefore we are obligated to give thanks to God. This is an evening of thanksgiving. And so I will share with you a favorite story that I have about a woman who's no longer with us, a woman who spent most of her life here in Los Angeles, very famous Mrs. Hatzenplatz. So Mrs. Hatzenplatz came to Los Angeles as a young bride in the 1920s. Coming here, there was nothing here. And she understood that if she was going to live here with her husband, she was going to have a mikveh. So she immediately went around and organized, and took a little while, but they got it together, and they ended up building the first mikveh in L.A. A number of years later, they had a baby. Baby had no program to go to. There was a Jewish program. She organized what later became the first Jewish daycare. A number of years later, her child was now ready for school. There was no Jewish school. So she herself got together and organized the first Jewish day school, the seeds of the first Jewish day school. A number of years later, she had a couple of children. And these children are now getting ready for high school. There wasn't a possibility of having a Jewish high school here. She organized what later became a JCC, a place for Jewish kids to come and to study a little bit and to be together and socialize, and a very important notion. Later on, when her children were older and were going to college, she herself went and organized a program for Jewish kids on the campus that later became the Hillel program, campuses worldwide. In the 1970s, when she was an old woman and people understood she was not going to be around for long, a few of the people in the community, a few hundred really, understood that we had to honor Mrs. Hatzenplatz before it's too late. So they got dinner together, and thousands of people came to this dinner. Over 1,000 people came to the dinner. Because she didn't belong to any particular organization, they auditioned different people to be the MC for the evening. And in the end, three people showed up at the hotel a week before the dinner to stand at the mic and give it their best shot to try to win the spot to be the MC for the evening. So the first fellow got up there and said, listen, people are not interested in hearing long speeches. People don't like long speeches at dinners. So I'm going to get up. This is what I would do. I would get up and I would say, we're here to honor Mrs. Hatzenplatz. And anyone who is interested in finding out more about the great things she's done, there's an exhibit outside, information on your table. Please come up, Mrs. Otzenflatz. Plaque, we'll all applaud. 5 minutes in and out, and everybody can eat dinner. So thank you very much. I sent him packing. The next fellow got up and said, I think she deserves a lot more honor than that. And he said, I think I would have everybody in the room who ever used that mikveh stand up and start cheering when he mentioned the mikveh. And then I'd have them stay up, and then I'd have everybody who ever sent a kid or themselves went to that daycare center or their grandparents went to that daycare center to stand up, et cetera, et cetera. Have them all stand up until everybody in the room is standing up, and they'll bring up on the stage and we'll have a big cheer. He said, that sounds pretty good. I think we'll give you the job. The third fellow said, just a second. I have a different idea. Brought him up. He stood up and he said, this is what I would do. I would say as follows. Mrs. Otzenflatz had only built a mikveh and not helped to build a daycare center, we would have this dinner. I want everyone who's ever benefited from a mikveh to stand up. And then he would say, I would say, and if she only built the Jewish daycare center and didn't build the first Jewish day school, we'd still have a dinner for her. Now I want to be you to be joined by the people who used the daycare center, and on and on and on, until finally he got to the last item, which is the campus group. And then I would say, and while you're standing, let me tell you what she did for us. She built a mikveh, and the place would go wild. And she built a Jewish daycare center, and the place would be screaming. And she built a Jewish day school, and everybody's up on their chairs screaming, Otzenflatz, Otzenflatz. And by the time that it would get to the point where I'd say, and she built the Jewish campus group, the place would be going wild, and she'd come up on the stage. And of course, that's the guy who got the job. Now, full disclosure, there may have been somebody named Mrs. Otzenflatz. I don't know who she was, but the story is still a story. Because that's exactly what we're going to see. We have to note that the first paragraph, the famous one, the one with all the songs, is just a setup. Look what we're saying. If God had only taken us out of Mitzrayim and not done the plagues, it would be enough. What's pshat enough? It would be enough for us to have this meal of Thanksgiving to thank God. Because each one of these items is deserving of tonight's Thanksgiving meal. And we go through the entire list. And then we argue as follows, al achad kama v'chama, how much more so do we have to thank God now that he's done all these things? And then we recite them, and that's the one where we should be cheering. We should be getting up and saying, Hotzianu Mitzrayim, and the place should be going nuts. Basavayim Shvatim, and we should be cheering. And by the time we get to the end of it, we should be jumping off on the chairs and bouncing off the walls, cheering for God. Because that's basically what's happening. Dayenu is the setup paragraph in which we somewhat coolly and detachedly point out that had God only done one of these things, we would still be obligated to thank him. Much more so that he's done all of these things for us, we're obligated to thank him. Yirtzeh Hashem, we will merit a full song, a full throat, and full joy next week. And indeed, we will never be able to say Dayenu. That it is enough, because God's blessings continue. Everyone should have a wonderful day, and Yirtzeh Hashem, tomorrow night, we'll do the second to final podcast, a whole different historic direction in understanding the Haggadah.